You're listening to Trek FM.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Welcome, everyone, to Trek FM's local watering hole, the casino, the Cloud City. Oh, wait, wrong show. This is the 602 Club, but maybe it's because of all of the strange aliens walking around. So I don't know what is going on. There's like a hammerhead guy and a Bith, and I don't know. It's crazy. But I hope you've grabbed something special from Ruby. We've got something, I think, fun to talk about. We're going to continue on with the Thrawn trilogy as we move towards The Force Awakens and kind of revisit something that we all thought might be the next series. So, of course, I have assembled my Jedi strike team, and I can't do Star Wars shows without these guys. Bruce, man, welcome back to the 602 Club.
Hey, Matthew, before you start recording, check out that blue girl over there, the Twilight over there. She's hot.
Bruce.
Yeah.
Bruce. Yeah. No more Corellian brandy for him, Ruby. Okay, thank you. John, jump in here. Save Bruce.
Wait, we're recording?
Yeah, no. Yeah. Sorry, I'm too busy enjoying my hot chocolate to chase off my case of, was it hive fever? What was it?
Hive fever. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I got a bad case Goodness. Of that. So by the end of the show, I may be insane-er.
Yes, once again, yeah. Hot chocolate makes it into
yeah,
the book.
It does. It does.
I fell out of the chair when I showed up again.
There's actually a lot of different alcoholic beverages that show up in here as well as hot chocolate. And they have the Tap Calf Cafe. So nice to know that yeah. exists. So, and that's canon now because it's in the new books. But before we jump in and dive in, I have to remind everybody that 602 Club is part of the Trek FM network. You can find all of our shows at itunes.com/Trek FM. You can also find us at trek.fm. That's online. That's our website. You can also find us on the interwebs on Twitter at Trek FM. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/Trek FM. We'd love to talk to you guys more, and the best place to do that is the listeners only discussion group, and that's the Babel Conference. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook or go to the website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. I love getting voicemails from people. Just got a fun voicemail today. I might end it. The show with it at the very, very end as the singer. But Alice Baker left us a nice, fun little voicemail, so really appreciate that. And of course, if you would like to talk to us about anything we talk about on the 602 Club in email format, if that works best for you, go to trek.fm/contact, choose the show, the 602 Club, that'll come to us, and we will be able to respond to you accordingly. Well, guys, as I said, we are going to continue on in the Thrawn trilogy, and the next book is Dark Force Rising. And this book really hits the ground running. I think in a lot of ways it mirrors Empire Strikes Back like that there isn't a lot, there's no setup. You know, it's going. And honestly, we jump right into three main storylines that are kind of going through that are continuations of what we had in the first book, Heir to the Empire. And so, quick question, I think even before we just jump into the storylines, I wanted to ask you guys about the feel of the storylines, and does it for you feel fluid, or does it feel a little too crowded?
I'll field it first. It feels too crowded. I think that there is so much going on, which normally isn't a knock on something. It's nice to have a lot of story and a lot to follow. But as a result, I feel that the way that he moves through tying everything together, everything feels too coincidental. Now, of course, as a Star Wars fan, you can fall back and you can say, oh, well, Will of the Force brought everything. But there is too much in the tiny nitty-gritty details where it was very obvious to me, at least, where there had been some things he couldn't overcome in terms of bringing people back together. And so, you know, maybe the Falcon just conveniently needs to be where it, you know, in an exact spot for people to find it, to bring it out of, you know, like where it was just like, well, that's a little, that's awful convenient. And it's the only way that it can get back to the main characters. All right. You know, like that, that's what I think, what takes away from any sense of fluidity is there are too many points in the story where it feels just like it's been forced back into everything running parallel.
Yes. Twi'lek. Anyway. I felt it was also too crowded. I'm actually glad you said that because I didn't think you were going to. It, again, like with the first book, I felt like it was jumping around to too many different places too quick. I felt the same way in at least the first half of this book. And with Thrawn, yeah, he knows everything. I mean, if he showed up to somebody's house and they weren't home, he could say, oh, I know where they went. They went to 7-Eleven. They're drinking a strawberry Slurpee right now.
He's like the Sherlock Holmes of Star Wars.
Yeah, but there's no clues. He just knows. He just knows.
It's not even by the will of the Force, too, because the guy doesn't even have any midichlorian count.
He's surrounded by Issa Alamiri, too. So, like, any shot at using the Force is gone.
That's true.
Maybe it's some new power we don't know about. Yeah. I don't know. But
like some Dark Force Rising or something?
There you go. That explains the title, Matthew. Very good. But the Millennium Falcon, I'm glad you brought that up too, because when Leia and Chewie left the Falcon with C-3PO, I was like, what'd they do with it? Where did it go? Because they were over the moon of Endor, and I wasn't really sure what happened to the Falcon. And then later they reveal that, yeah, it's just sitting out there in orbit, just laying there, abandoned. And like, who abandons the Falcon?
Yes.
That made no sense to me. I mean, I knew it needed to happen for the story, but come on. I mean, the ship's just laying out there for anyone to take, and guess what happened? Someone took it.
I do have to ask, why didn't you just land the Falcon on Endor and cover it with, like, you know, the camouflage or whatever? You know, you can lock it up. There aren't going to be any Ewoks in it. They're not really prone to technology, as we've seen in
the Ewoks would even remember these guys. They could show back up and be like, hey, keep an eye on this, okay? Yub yub.
Yeah,
right.
They probably could. And, you know, 3PO was with her, so they think he's a god, so, you know, would have been fine.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you guys. See, you know, there is a lot going on, and I'll talk about this later, but the pace and the amount that's going on, again, reminds me of the prequels, and the amount of stuff that's happening. And I don't know how I feel about it. I really don't. I was thinking about this because I was looking at the outline before we started, and I really don't know if I feel like there's really too much going on, because this book, to me, at the same time, it soars. Like, I have no... It reads so fast. There's a Bantha poo load going on. I mean, there's so much happening in this story, but I'm never bored. I'm always turning the page, and I just can't stop. Like, these books, I mean, this is almost a 400-page book, and I read this in a few days, just like 3 days, because I sit there and I can consume hundreds of pages at a time because it reads so well. But that's just me personally. So I can understand the criticism that there's a lot going on, but at the same time, I don't know. I mean,
Zahn writes it very well. I agree with you. His writing is fluid, but it's just that, and to go back to your, you know, the prequels do have a lot going on as well, but everything feels very organic through it. There's nothing, you know, maybe I'm in the minority. I don't think I'm in the minority here, but with the prequels, everything seems to flow along a due course. Like every single plot line goes where it needs to go. Whereas with this, they're sort of shoehorned together. That's where I think the difference is. And in terms of the quality of the writing, again, Zahn does a good job putting it together in such a way that you can read it and consume it quickly. But by the time I got to the end of the book, I'll be honest, I remember having this reaction back when I read it the first time too, which was, all right, let's wrap it up. Let's bring it together now. Let's get everything done. I know that we're near the end, and I know you're not going to resolve this. So let's pull the plug and get through this. Like I felt that way for about the last 50 pages. I read the new paperback edition this time around, and it was, I don't know, it's like 440 pages or something like that. So maybe it was something having to do with the format. But just at the tail end of the book, even though there's this big space battle going on, my feeling wasn't one of danger for the characters. It was one of, okay, let's bring this to a close.
I think it's a valid criticism. I don't know even now how I feel about it. I do feel like that there were some points of the story where things kind of get dropped on you and you're like, oh, where did that come? You know, like that just seems to come out of nowhere, like certain new characters that come in and you're just, it's all, but I don't know. I guess the other part I'm realizing about this story is it really is one story. It feels like The Lord of the Rings. Mm. There's no beginning and there's no end until you, you know what I'm saying? Like there's the beginning and there's the end. There's no middle. There's just the whole story and they cut it arbitrarily almost into parts. That's kind of how it feels because, you know, and then you're reading The Two Towers, it just kind of flows right into the next book. And the only demarcation points are the way that Tolkien breaks that story up. So you're reading it very literally in the sense that, well, you read one story point at a time. So just like the characters, you don't know what's going on somewhere else. So, I don't know that I'm really realizing that rereading this because I didn't remember that part, that this was more one continuous story in three parts than it is three separate books.
I don't want to pick on this novel, but I will. So, and I do like it, so don't get me wrong. But here's the thing. I can give you a summary of how this story plays out real easy. A major character goes to a planet. They're there to meet someone and talk to someone about something. And in the middle of the conversation, the Empire shows up. They have to leave the planet. Another character goes to another planet and goes to talk to someone. And the Empire shows up and they need to get out of there. Like, it just felt like it was repetitive throughout where the Empire's just showing up. Like, I just kept waiting. When are they going to show up? Oh, here they are.
Which is very Empire Strikes Back, though. That's exactly what happens in Empire, if you remember. Every place that Han and Leia go when they're escaping, the Empire somehow shows up.
But see, they're being specifically pursued through the film. Luke leaves Dagobah, and there's no Imperial Star Destroyer or agent of the Empire that shows up and chases him off. And so I think it's different in that sense. I think it's very interesting when you invoke Tolkien, because I agree with you that I came to sort of the same realization that it's a shame that this is split up this way. But I almost wonder if it is going to be split up this way, if he should have split it up more the way Tolkien did and pursued one set of characters' story arc up to a certain point and then roll back time and then go back to where Han and Lando are and pursue them through the whole thing instead of intercutting it so much, which of course isn't going to feel like the movies, but I think would have possibly at least allowed some of the storylines more time to breathe, because Luke's time on Jomark is incredibly abbreviated as a result. You do not spend enough time with it. Like, I was looking forward to this after finishing Heir to the Empire both times. Oh, right. Luke's going to go to Jomark and he's going to go hang out with Sabaoth, whatever you want to call him. And he...
Sabaoth?
Yeah, well, all right, fine. But he is going to go there and there's going to be this major thing and he's going to have a realization. And instead, it's like, it happens, but it's in the margins. And I'm like, if anything, there needs to be more focus on that. There really needs to be more focus on that because this really is Luke's first test as an individual Jedi and being able to tell the difference between the dark and the light.
Well, because so much of Star Wars in the films focuses on that journey and learning the Force, and this feels like that was going to be the meat of this book mm-hmm. for the Force, and it was very brief. This is the part I was looking forward to the most, and then Mara Jade shows up and says, "Come on, Luke, we got to leave," and I'm like, "No, it's just starting. Right. Leave Luke there until the Empire shows up. That's the format of this book."
Well, I'm with you guys, because that is the stuff that I really, really enjoyed, that whole, and this outline, we're just going to start mixing things up because we're going to end up talking about all sorts of things. That the whole Jedi training part, to me, was so interesting with Luke and Sabaoth, because, you know, Luke has only been trained by two people, a little bit by Obi-Wan and then a little bit by Yoda, a little bit more than he was with Obi-Wan, but that's it. And like, I kept feeling bad for Luke, because it's like, it's just too bad he doesn't have that Jedi Old Testament to let him know how things are supposed to be done, you know, what it's supposed to look like to be a Jedi, what the rules are. It's too bad none of this is written down anywhere for him.
but see, that's... like, that's the whole thing, is like Luke's journey, at least the way I've always interpreted it, is Luke is a rebirth of everything. He's, you know, the old ways are no longer valid and they're gone. And it would have been nice to see Luke have an awakening in this, where he goes back to, quote unquote, train with.
There's been an awakening.
Right, yeah. But he goes back to, you know, quote unquote, train and learn more. It would have been nice to have him have more of a genuine internal realization at some point to say, why am I going back and learning the way it was? I'm the way it's going to be. And I think this is our first indication of why the EU wound up alienating myself and others like me, I guess, in that it became very quickly about Luke traveling backward and trying to reestablish an old way instead of forging a new path. And I think that this is our first hint of it.
Yes and no, because Luke changes the Jedi Order pretty drastically from what it used to be. I think that the thing is this is where you get into the point where you realize Lucas isn't involved, and that person who knows Star Wars so well and exactly how it works isn't there. So you're going to get different authors giving different points of view, and Luke is going to be written kind of inconsistently for quite a long time. And I think that's really what ends up happening, is that each author and series, you know, Kevin J. Anderson's going to come along and do his series, and, you know, other people are going to come along and do their series, and then, you know, it keeps getting added to, and it wasn't like there was one vision for where this Jedi Order and what Luke's going to do is going to happen. It's not coming from one man anymore. It's coming from a story group. I hate to say that, but that's kind of one of the things that worries me about the Force Awakens and all the other stuff, is that we're writing by committee now, and at least they're writing by committee in the sense that they're very firmly working towards a realized goal and having inner consistency. But here in this EU, and what happens later on, you're not going to get that because that just isn't there, because each author kind of has a little bit different take. And honestly, there isn't a lot of consistency, I don't think, until you start to get to the New Jedi Order, where they like really start to clamp down on where the story's going. They start putting a tighter rein on the authors and trying to work together and make things more cohesive. And I just don't think that happens until that point.
Well, then I guess Zahn is the indicator of why they had to, you know, put a tighter rein on people later on. But I think that this is your first hint of the damage that's going to be done, that's going to drive people away before New Jedi Order series even comes into being.
Well, I would say that Zahn was the one for me that I read and always enjoyed his take because, you know, his Hand of Thrawn trilogy I really enjoyed, wrapping up the Bantham series until Del Rey took over.
Well, I'm just talking about Luke's journey in specific. Luke becomes for a time obsessed with going backward instead of going forward, and I just think that this robbing him of a personal character arc and having Mara Jade show up and say, "No, you knucklehead, you're under the influence of a bad guy. Let's go." Like that takes Luke's agency away from him. That removes his maturity that he's earned through the movies.
No,
as a character.
Luke realizes he's got a crazy guy pretty quickly.
Yeah, he thought before Mara.
Yeah,
he thought he was unstable, but at no point in the story did I feel that Luke reflected any deeper than that. He didn't find, like, if a crazy person is telling you the history of the galaxy, shouldn't you be questioning his version of history more strongly and then leaving
right.
of your own
or staying and trying to turn this guy and almost become the mentor, and he becomes more of the student because he's insane and trying to bring sanity back to him because there's such few Jedi.
Well, and I think that's what Luke was going to do until Mara showed up and needed his help, and she went with him.
The thing is, it just doesn't. I don't think that it's given enough time to really come across. Like I think I
can agree with you.
You know, I think that that's why I'm left with this impression of like Luke's agency being taken away is because it's so his time on Jomark is just crammed in there, and.
Well, and I'm hoping that's where the next book will pick up because, you know, it's going to be him and Mara and some commandos on a trip to, you know, the planet. My mind is completely blank right now. Where they're going to be the ones who try and take out the cloning facilities. Spoiler alert for a book that's, 20 years old. But, no, I can kind of agree with you because I think it is pretty interesting to watch Luke realize this dude belongs in Jedi Arkham. He's nuts.
Yeah.
You know, and Luke has that too. He has the thought in his head and he's talking to Mara about how, you know, Vader was far gone and he was able to bring him back. And I think that's his plan with Sabaoth. It just, there's something that's really interesting. I thought that he does here, Zahn does, in tying Luke to Mara, and there's something about her that he's drawn to and like he feels protective of, and he can't explain it yet, you know, like, so it feels like to me that the forces at work in some odd ways with Luke, and I can't really judge his storyline completely, I think, until we read The Last Command.
Yeah, I agree.
Because
once we get to that last book, then we'll know.
It is really interesting here, the whole idea of, you know, the prequels don't exist, so we're not dealing with how the Jedi were in the prequels, and we only have this crazy Jedi to kind of tell us how things were, and Luke realizes this guy treats people like they're Greek gods, basically, and everybody else is a peasant. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, his Sabaoth's version of how the Jedi ruled and all of that, which is completely different from what we know for the prequels, and yet we don't have the prequels yet with these books. So Luke trying to figure this out makes much more sense to me when I divorce myself from the fact that the prequels didn't exist, so I didn't have any idea how the Jedi used to be, and therefore it is, I'm asking the same questions honestly that I feel like Luke is asking because he doesn't know, you know, and I can't expect him to have known the mistakes of the Jedi beforehand because even for me as the reader at that point they don't exist. So I think that makes for a really interesting conundrum, and not having that part of the storyline, I think you do end up with a more drawn-out process of Luke trying to figure out where he's going and all that stuff. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the whole Sabaoth thing speaks to sort of the notion that a lot of us had before the prequels of how the Jedi were, which was they were much more roaming samurai-like. You know, yes, they went on missions on behalf of the Republic and stuff like that, but it would have been completely within the realm of believability for somebody to be a complete hard ass like Sabaoth and a complete, you know, gentle touch like Obi-Wan, and they're still Jedi masters, and they're still, well, I mean, I don't think we even thought of Obi-Wan as a Jedi master by that point, because he only refers to himself as a Jedi Knight in the original trilogy. But, you know, like, this version of the Jedi is much less uniform and much more feudal. And I think it fits with the impression that a lot of people had before the prequel era was established.
And it's going to create that sense that is going to make people so upset when the Jedi don't live up to those expectations when they reach the prequels. I really do think so.
See, I took a different, I had a totally different approach to this, because I'm reading this book knowing the prequels. I'm not looking at this book as, okay, this came before the prequels, so let me put my mindset into that. I'm approaching this book fresh and new, because I don't remember much from this, obviously, from when I read it years ago. So a lot of it's new to me. And I'm looking to how it fits in now. And the way that impression of the Jedi were to me when Sabaoth is explaining them, I'm thinking, this guy's so insane that he's building up these Jedi as if they're these gods and mythical beings that, you know, no one seems to know, Luke doesn't know much about, and he's portraying them in a different manner than what they really were. Like, he wasn't real honest.
Okay. I can go with that. That's a good way to retcon. I was actually, if you want to slip into the post, you know, prequel era establishment and everything, in a sense, he's almost like Darkness and Umbara. I forget that master's name.
Oh, Pong Krell. Yeah. Yes.
He's
yes.
like that, where he's yes, Sabaoth is nuts. Sabaoth, whatever, is nuts. But he, at the same time, I think he has he's like Joker crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like, you don't know when the nutso part has taken over and when the more calm, rational part. So he could be just straight up lying to Luke, or he could just honestly believe it and has built it up in his mind, you know, while in seclusion or something.
Right. Even though it's not truth, that's how he built it up in his mind. That's where he's living.
Right.
It's a fantasy.
You want to see me make this lightsaber disappear?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I mean, I like that. And I think what's really interesting, because earlier in the book, you know, Luke is confronted with somebody who asks him to be an arbiter of an argument. And Luke is completely taken aback by this. And yet there is still, and this is where I think it really does kind of still fit in with the milieu of what we know from the prequels, Rebels, all this stuff. There is this remembrance of the Jedi that hasn't been scrubbed clean by the Empire, where people still do remember them as being not villains, but being heroes, you know, that they weren't bad people. They could be trusted. You know, not everybody has bought the Empire's line, hook, line, and sinker. And, you know, this character, he asks Luke to, you know, make a ruling, basically, and that they would abide by whatever he said. And the way that Luke, I thought that was a great scene, because the way that Luke goes about that, he listens, he puts himself into the Force and listens, you know, and all of that. And then, of course, Sabaoth is when he's telling Luke to do that, it's get this done quickly. Use might to make right, you know, your power to make right. Everything that basically Yoda said not to do, Sabaoth is telling Luke to do. And it's really interesting to see that Luke is really on the right path. But as to our point earlier, it's going to take Luke a little while. And that's why I like here that he hasn't set up a Jedi Order yet, because Luke's still trying to figure out, you know, like, he's got things to figure out, and he wants to make sure that he does this thing right, because I think he does clearly understand how wrong it can go if you don't do it right. You know, it, even if it lasts for 1,000 years, if it brings the, you know, some kind of empire back, that's not what Luke is looking for. So I think it does really set up at least an interesting stage for the rest of the EU to be built upon. What the rest of the EU will do and whether or not that works at all, how those authors take it later on, completely different story. But I think at least Zahn's setting up a pretty interesting and compelling story for Luke that I really want to see continued. Like, you know, I'm torn by knowing where the EU goes and almost wanting this to still be a jumping off point somehow, because it's still grabbing me, and I think that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Did you get the sense, though, whether, you know, setting aside the whole Sabaoth lying, telling the truth thing, whatever, there's still very much that sense that I think we all held on to until the prequels of the Clone Wars having taken place a lot longer before Luke was alive, because the Honegger, are we pronouncing it that way? How do we pronounce the plant? Honegger? Yeah, sure.
Sure,
with the Nogiri, let's do it.
Okay. They say they had been under the yoke of the Empire since the Clone Wars, which were 44 years previous. And I'm like, man, no matter how I try to work this math out, that doesn't work with the timeline anymore. So,
oh, I worked it out. I'll show you how to do that.
Oh, all right. Thank you. I appreciate that. Is it using that new Common Core math? Because I can't figure that stuff out.
Well, you know, years are represented differently by different planets and different solar systems. And so this is a pre-Empire date, which is more rapid dates than the BBY dates. So it's all, there's a mathematical formula to make it all work out.
That actually makes some crazy sense.
No, because they specifically address the time difference where they say it's 48 years on Honegger, but 44 years as the Empire reckons it.
Right. That's two different date systems. There's many more.
Oh, okay.
And they reference earlier that Luke is frustrated and hoping that the New Republic doesn't create its own calendar system.
Right.
Since every, you know, regime tries to create its own. So, yeah, that's pretty funny. That's very clever.
Pick your dating system. You pick your age. You can be younger if you want. Depends on the dating
system.
Yeah,
that's great.
How
Leia
old are
shaved
you?
Off 25. 20 years. Yeah, so I love it. Well, okay, so... There is the other side of the story, you know, because we learned last time that the Nogri had been involved with the Empire for a very long time, and that they saw Vader as being their savior, and Leia felt like she could use that to her advantage to help them, but also help the New Republic, and I thought that was an actually. To me, it was a really interesting story to see the background of just how devious and terrible the Empire was and the way that it treated people and used people and had no compulsion about it. I really like the way they drive that home. And it's not in your face. It's just, I felt like that was a great story. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I like how they were deceived by the Empire. The Empire switched it around to make it look like that they were their saviors and Darth Vader was the guy there to rescue them. And instead, they were doing the opposite. They're poisoning their crops by putting this fake grass that kills the crops and makes them dependent on the Empire. So they're very ruthless. And it took Lady Vader, as she's known to them, to come in there and show them the errors of their ways and have them turn against the Empire. So that was a cool storyline.
Well, I did enjoy how the Mial Yarush came and showed them the light while dancing that line between, you know, not taking away their reverence for Vader while at the same time using it to her own advantage. But the one question I had, and I apologize for having this question, but everybody who smells her knows that she belongs to Vader's lineage, that she is the daughter of Darth Vader. However, we find out that Kabarak, who was the first one to recognize her as Lady Vader on Kashyyyk, he is the grandson of the first people that Vader came across. So how do they all know how Vader smells?
Well, he smells kind of like there's a nice earthy peatiness with a slight sense of like lilac and cedar.
But did they keep like a section of his cape somewhere on Honegger? And when you were old enough, you were brought up and it was like, sniff Vader's cape. Then you know that it's awesome.
Sniff Vader's cape.
No. How else does everybody know what he smelled like?
I don't know.
Well, he would smell
apparently
mechanical, wouldn't he?
Okay. But, I mean...
I figured he smelled like burnt toast, yeah. I mean...
Did they... Was that like their battle musk or something like that? Like they doused themselves with essence of Vader before they went into battle or something? I don't know.
If he doesn't smell like a sausage, you know, that's been overcooked, I don't know what does.
But I still want to know how everybody knows how he smells. Nobody can answer that for me.
Do you think maybe it has something to do with his force ability and that there's something in the force?
So they're smelling the force. So now we've gone from Salamiri pushing out the force to people that can smell the force. I'll roll with it. Sure.
Hey,
no, it's all possible.
It's like enjoying the color 9. So, you know, yeah. I mean.
I don't know. Maybe he used a certain deodorant and they had those around. Well, you know, he had only been dead for 5 years, so maybe he visited quite often. And so it was just 5 years ago, they still remember that scent.
All right.
Well, he uses degree. It's heat activated. So. Oh, gosh. That was, I mean.
It's not the only smelling character, but we'll get to that later.
What I love about the story, though, that the Empire seals their own fate because of their own evil towards the Nogri. It's like evil never prospers for long. And it's their treatment of them finally is their undoing of that relationship that they have. They had been able to make themselves look like heroes for a long time. But, you know, it just took Leia coming in and pointing out the evil, and then the evil actually showing itself for what it really was. And I just really liked that, you know, the angel of light might not be the angel of light. And if it's not, well, they're not going to be able to stay that way forever. And so the devil always shows their true colors after a while. And
yeah, life falls apart over time.
Yeah, yeah. So I thought that was just a great part of this story. I feel like it's one of the parts of the story that's the strongest to me because of the theme that's working in there.
Oh, yeah.
And it feels very Star Wars in that sense.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree. And I think it's also nice to see Leia specifically trying to undo the... Like, she's doing penance for what her father did. So she is taking on the mantle of being a Skywalker in this storyline, where she is specifically taking it upon herself to right the wrong of what her father did. And I also like the fact that when she does talk with them and they say, oh, well, you're just saying this because you want us to join the Republic. And she says, it would be great if you did, but I don't care. I really just want you to be able to be self-sustaining. Like, that speaks to a nobility in her character that I think is very important.
Well, and what I love about that is that she embraces what it means to be a Jedi in her way. She's not having to be the Jedi quite like Luke, and that's okay. And that's something that will not get played out very well in the EU with Leia's Jedi training for too long. But I think... Again, Zahn is setting up a very nice platform, a nice foundation for Leia to become a Jedi that, you know, it reminds me, you know, the Jedi Academy game Jedi Outcast, you know, there were those different types of Jedi, the Counselor, the Warrior, whatever, I can't remember.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, I just remember there being different types of Jedi, and we even see that, you know, referenced in like the Clone Wars. I mean, you know, you have the Jedi guards at the temple. They're obviously well known for their fighting ability and all that kind of thing. And you have different types of Jedi, and not all Jedi are just, you know, lightsaber wielding, aggressive negotiations type of people. You know, some are librarians, not necessarily good librarians, but that's a whole nother podcast. So I like that they're setting up that Leia can be a Jedi and build on the legacy of the Skywalkers, but she doesn't have to do it exactly the same way that Luke does to make her a valid mantle of that name. And I think Zahn's just doing a real service to that character by continuing what's already been done in the original trilogy and furthering that character as we move forward. So I just really, really appreciate that. Well, the other storyline that we get here, that the other kind of main storyline, is Han and Lando and the political machinations of what's going on with Falea and trying to figure out how he has worked this bank transfer. Yeah, that's right. We're going to talk about bank transfers, just like the prequels, into Admiral Akbar's account and all of that. So they go to unravel that mystery. What did you guys think about getting to pal around with Han and Lando for so much of this book?
I thought it was neat. You know, it was a different way to handle it instead of having Han go off with Chewie. I mean, it would have been very difficult to have that storyline, I think, without meaningful dialogue written out between the two. Whereas, you know, with Leia pairing off with Chewie but then bringing along 3PO, you didn't have just one character speaking the whole time with, you know, somebody else tagging along that doesn't ever utter a, you know, like a real readable word. You know, I like the fact that it shored up the buddy aspect of their relationship. You know, what was there before Empire Strikes Back. And so I liked it for that reason.
I wish it was more Starsky and Hutch or something like that. I don't know. It was cool to see them together. I don't know. I was wishing maybe it was a little more funnier, a little more buddy-buddy, and they're taking more jabs at each other than they did. It was all right. When they went on the casino boat submarine thing or whatever, I think there was
It was like a Gungan submarine, yeah.
Yeah, with no Gungans. But no, that would have been a good opportunity to really play something really fun up. I guess that's what I'm looking for. I mean, this book was very straightforward all the way through, and this would have been a good pairing to add some fun to it.
That's a fair
point. It was interesting to me how much, they really grow the character of Lando to make him kind of a well-traveled man about the galaxy and one who knows a lot of things and obviously has had his hands in lots of different types of pots looking to score it big. And so, you know, when conveniently Lando had been a person who had studied the Katana fleet looking for it, it just kind of made sense with the character. And so I felt like Zahn understands the characters enough to write them in a way that feels as if you add something to them or talk about them, it makes sense with what we know, you know? So as you layer, he's layering well, I think. And that's what I found about the Lando and Han storyline there. And I really appreciate it, you know, because Lando for me is not personally my favorite character, but I really like the way that Zahn writes him in this series. I think he's really interesting, and I just felt like that worked to me. So it was an interesting, fun storyline. I do think that theirs is the weakest storyline here because...
Well, that's the whole reason we're like,
What I mean is that it feels like all the things that they find out are found out in other places. So that when it comes together, they haven't really found out all that much. Because to go back with Luke, he's going to catch up with Mara, and he's going to be the one who helps save Card, and that's what brings Card to the Katana fleet. And so it's like their storyline almost just felt like it wasn't completely...
see,
yeah, they didn't
accomplish
anything.
Yeah, exactly. They don't accomplish anything.
Well, I mean, they do manage to meet, you know, Senator Garm Bel Iblis, and so
that is true. And that's, let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, Bel Iblis, I liked as a character. I thought that, thinking back to a comment from when we were talking about Heir to the Empire, I think Bruce, you mentioned how Zahn said that Card is how he saw what Han would have become had he not met up with everybody or something like that. I think that Iblis has, there's enough mention of his charm and his natural charisma that he feels like yet another different version of Han, the guy who was respectable from the beginning, as opposed to somebody who went down the smuggler path. And I would have sacrificed gladly a little bit from Han and Lando's earlier parts of their adventures for more time with Bel Iblis, because I think it's fascinating and also very realistic, in a sense, to have somebody with a backstory where they hate the Empire, they want to fight the Empire, but they didn't like the way the rebellion was being handled, and so they struck out on their own. I think that that makes for a very interesting sort of character.
Well, and we talked about this book feeling crowded several times, including this one, John, where you're mentioning, yo, I wish we had a little more time. I wish I had more time. And I think that's where I feel, and maybe it's just the kind of book we want. I think Zahn's trying to keep a pace going, and we want it to just kind of breathe a little. We want to kind of dig deeper into these characters, into these situations. But yeah, that was the weakest storyline. And again, I feel like it could have done something more with it, made it a little more fun. But the payoff did come later in the last, what, chapter or two?
Well, and I think what was great, though, is what I really loved and where I could see wanting more time is that when Bel Iblis is talking about setting up the rebellion, he's the one who called the meeting for the three separate rebel factions to come together and form what we know as the Alliance. That would be what we saw in A New Hope. And he kind of gets pushed out because he's not quite as charismatic as Mon Mothma. And that's what causes him to go on his own. And like you said, John, I think that's really fascinating. Somebody who hates the Empire and just not quite a fan of the leadership. And what was really interesting is that, of course, I've just seen the last Hunger Games film, and that Mon Mothma almost feels like President Coin.
Yes, good point.
Like she's, what Garum is worried about is her having too much power and turning into basically an empress.
We need Katniss here.
Yeah, exactly. Why is Leia not Katniss?
Right.
Get that Wookiee bowcaster out.
She'll shoot first.
But yeah, that's I like him as an addition. I think he's fascinating, and he'll turn in, if I remember correctly from, you know, the rest of the EU, he does turn out to be a pretty fascinating character. So I really do like that addition. And yeah, as crowded as the story was, that one new character like that was one that, especially by the end, like you said, he comes into play in the very end, and you're like, oh, yes! You know, not only that, but, you know, we talked about it in the first book, you know, you didn't really like Card, John, but I feel like he's much more nuanced in this storyline and much more interesting character, as he's a man who almost has that Han-esque storyline where he's being pushed into action to the good side. Like, he's real, you know what I'm saying? Like, you finally pushed him to the edge where he has to make the choice between the Empire or the New Republic, and he can't side with the Empire, so he's going to join the New Republic.
Yeah, although the knowledge of where the Dark Force fleet is appears to be as well kept as, I don't know, like Batman's secret identity nowadays, where it's like everybody seems to know
you want me
about
tell me?
The fleet and
your
where
secret
it is.
Identity.
Yeah, no, I mean, everybody has an idea of where the Dark Force is, it seems. And it's, I don't know, that, like, I guess tying Bel Iblis to the Dark Force, and like, there was just so much where it was just like, again, I think it gets back to it gets back to everything feeling so coincidental, you know, and just sort of fitting together in a forced way.
Yeah, because that last scene with the dark forces, everybody showing up, and I was like, wait, I can't remember. How did the Empire know that was here? And oh yeah, and Bel Iblis knows because, but I wasn't sure if Bel Iblis actually knew.
Right.
You know, and it was like, but everybody seemed to know now, and it's all at the same time.
Or like Grapevine, everybody told somebody else, I'm going here. Let's go check it out. So like there was, you know, that big, yeah.
Well, that's what made me wonder if there was some kind of leak as soon as the New Republic's on its way. It leaks to the Empire. It leaks to Bel Iblis. It's just all of a sudden everybody's involved because this leak just went out because as soon as one went, everybody knows.
Well, I think there's throwaway line where it says Han like sent a message to Senna.
Oh, Senna? Was that it?
Yeah, but it's one line in the middle of the big battle. And I remember seeing it, and I'm like, "That's wow! That deserved more time." Yeah. You know, you could have given me a paragraph.
But no, remember though too that remember when Han has been at the meeting and they've been yelling back and forth about whether or not the Katana fleet is it real or not, and he stays behind and he talks to Mon Mothma. I'm wondering if Iblis shows up. Because Mon Mothma has reached out to him. Because that's a point in the storyline where Han stays. You don't see the conversation. Zahn doesn't give you the conversation, but Han has stayed back to talk with Mon Mothma while everybody else is gone to get ready to leave.
But is Card given Mon Mothma the location? I got the impression that Card
holds on to the location until they leave.
Card holds his cards.
Yeah. No.
Right. But if Mon Mothma had contacted Bel Iblis and asked him to join, but does that fly with the story?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
It was just a question because there's that point where...
He specifically shows up because Han told Senna where they were. Right. And then he says specifically at a point... he says, so I wasn't asked here specifically by the Republic. And Leia says, you weren't, but you are now.
Right.
I want
you
here.
Yep.
And it happened. But the thing is, everything is so crowded. Like we keep talking about how crowded it is. Everything's so crowded. And all of these points are thrown at you in the last big battle. And it's like, wait a minute, guy. Like that, this shouldn't be lost in the chatter here of the action that's going on. That's why I think so many – I don't think that it's rare for people to come out of it and say, so wait a minute. How did he know he was there? Or why did they show up? And on top of that
– you really have to be paying attention.
Yeah. And on top of that, I feel that Zahn really telegraphed the big reveal at the end. I don't know if this was my reaction way back when, but my reaction now was, okay, we all know the secret about the troopers and Mount Tantus and everything. Okay, come on. Because everybody kept hammering on the idea of there's no way to raise an army. There's no way to raise an army. There's no way to raise an army. And it's like, okay, I see where you're going with this. And I remember what you talked about in the last book. I get it.
So why do we need an army to run these ships? That's where I was confused. It was like you need 2,000 on a ship to run it?
Yes, because apparently you need 2,000 on the ship to run it when it normally needs a complement of 16,000, which seems a bit excessive. And so the 2,000, they were saying that the Empire didn't have the troops to staff the 200 ships. So if there are 200 ships and they need 2,000 each, apparently the Empire couldn't press enough people into service. I don't know how that works. Although
why would you need 2,000 on a ship when they can remotely from a different ship drive a ship that's just sitting there empty?
I think
the idea was, you know, you can make that, you may be able to make that ship move, but you can't do everything in that ship that you would need. Like, because what was it? And that was really interesting. The idea that this is where Star Wars gets really crazy. Those massive ships, you know, that you see the Star Destroyers and things like that. You need like 16,000 people to run one of those things. That's that's an amazing amount of people.
Yes.
And so then, of course, what was really interesting is the storyline gives us a nice reason for the fact that, one, we don't have massive computer cores in Star Wars because the Katana fleet was lost, and so therefore people went to droids instead of massive computer cores that were slaved together. So that was kind of a little fun tidbit of why, you know, you don't end up with Star Trek-style computers running ships. You end up with, you know, hundreds and thousands of droids on ships.
Sure.
Running things. My thought was kind of why you just wouldn't have lots of droids running a ship. Why would you need all those people? It would be a lot easier to manufacture droids than it would be, you know, to press that many people into service. But that was just... That's where I got to. It was like, you don't necessarily have to have that many people. You can create as many droids as you want to do whatever you want.
Well, maybe the Empire hires people based on how they smell.
That's true.
Smells yeah. such a big thing.
I'm sorry, I don't like the smell of lemon.
Yeah, well, there, you know, I honestly think it's a point simply to introduce the big surprise at the end of the book. And in terms
Which
of
is
the droids...
Cool.
Yeah, but in terms of the droids, you could retcon it to say, well, because of the Clone Wars with the droid armies, that's why they won't staff them with droids, is because that, you know, that leads to its own problems.
Well, droids just don't have that same will to live, so they won't put as much into the effort to survive and conquer others.
But you also don't need to feed them, and they create no waste.
Well, that's why they have at least 500 chefs aboard the ships. And there's a McDonald's, too, down in the basement.
You know, I don't even want to think about the quartermasters on those poor ships. Must have just been, that must have been just an awful job. But anyway. Yeah, I mean, Of course, I think the biggest thing to try to retcon is the clones themselves.
Really?
Because,
why is that?
Because the way that they are, how quickly they're created and the way that they are deployed is, it seems to run contradictory to what we later find out in the prequels about the way that the clones are created. I mean, the way I retcon it now, because I you know, just for sort of like a fun mental exercise is, because I think he wrote a short story where the Sparty cylinders were special and separate from the Kamino project. And so what makes these clones different is that they are grown so much faster and they're not given even that 10 years to develop into, you know, fully functioning 20-year-old adults and everything. And the thing is, I'm trying not to go into spoilers for the next book because there's another aspect of the clones that coincides and resonates with why Luke feels that they are different in the Force than, because that is definitely something where Luke senses something different about these troopers on a fundamental Force level.
Yeah, they don't have a, you know, high midichlorian count, so just kidding.
Yeah. No,
right,
but
well, times change. You can do things faster. I mean, my grandmother took an hour and a half to bake a lasagna, and I can do it faster in a microwave 20, 30 years later.
Ah, but the Sparty cylinders are an oven from 40 years ago, and you're using that to try to microwave your lasagna.
Takes forever
yeah.
to bake a clone. Jeez.
No, but I mean, like, you can retcon that, the speed of cloning. I can get that, but the way that the clones are just doesn't. Maybe I'm projecting too far into what I remember from The Last Command, because
they started the clones earlier, right?
Well, they didn't find that mountain.
Yeah, Mount Tantus
until the heir to the Empire.
Right.
So, no, you know, I as I said earlier, I'm really reading this and pushing all that stuff out of my mind. Because it can't impact what I think of this story, because I can't expect it to be beholden to anything.
Because Lucas
is
wrong.
Fun.
Lucas came after this.
Yeah, it is fun, though, to be able to talk about the differences and how it kind of works.
Sure.
And I think that's what it, to me, it's like, it's not a fight or whatever. It's just a great conversation to be able to have about how the different ideas of cloning here, and then, you know, say cloning in the prequels.
Well, I mean, at a very fundamental level, one of the things that that I look at it with is the Kaminoans weren't the only cloners out there. And so very easily they're just using different
that
technology.
That is a good idea. I love
there
it.
There you go.
Yeah, that's very well, and even think about that. Dex says the Kaminos, they're cloners and damn good ones.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they're the only cloners
right.
out
exactly.
there. He just means they're good.
They're good. They take their time
yeah.
at making
that's
their
That's right.
You get a better
right.
lasagna with
right.
the Kaminoans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They bake a nice clone.
Yeah, these clones are more Chef Boyard.
Hey,
okay.
Don't
I do want to talk to you guys a little bit about that idea. Because, again, you know, the prequels for so many people, they got so pissed off by there being politics and banking factions and clans and all of this kind of stuff. It is so interesting to me to see how many of those ideas exist within this story as the New Republic is trying to set itself up, as did with the prequel era, with the politics involved. Thrawn is even behind the scenes, indirectly taking advantage of characters without them knowing it, playing them in the New Republic against each other. banking issues, I mean, and we even have, you know, begun the second Clone War has by the end of this story. So I think it's fascinating to me how even with the wide open canvas that Zahn has, he creates something that feels very familiar when you get to the prequels, if you ask me, because a lot of this story is mirrored in what we get with all of the different factions, the somewhat confusing nature of what's going on. So you need to reread it maybe more than, you know, once, or obviously see the films more than once to get where everybody's going and who's being controlled by what and what all their motivations are. Like, all of this, it doesn't have the depth thematically that we have with the prequels, but it sure does have a lot of the same kind of machinations.
Yeah, if I were to compare the two, this feels like an early story. Like some of the plot points, especially discussing the past, feel like early story draft treatments of what happened prior to the original trilogy. And I think that, you know, it's a completely valid thing. It's completely enjoyable, but I think that it did wind up, you know, hampering later impressions, because once it's put in print, it no longer feels like a story draft to somebody. And so, you know.
Yeah, I mean, especially when it's officially licensed by Lucasfilm. So,
yeah.
And it was the first time that had happened since, you know, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, that something was coming out that was supposed to be the next thing that happens yeah. in this story.
If you want something that's fun to retcon. Or try yeah, to retcon yeah. Splinter of the Mind's Eye. That's a doozy.
There you go.
Oh, I read that earlier this year, too.
That is a doozy.
Okay, so wanted to talk to you guys a little bit just about some interesting ideas that come out throughout the story. One, we've already talked about some of them, but there I just wanted to talk about a few. One is the way that what we learn about Mara Jade and the fact that she was the Emperor's hand. Which means basically she almost feels kind of like an Inquisitor, but at the Emperor's command and nobody else's. And strangely enough, her power through the Force seems to be more connected to the Emperor than the Force, and that's only now starting to kind of reemerge. And I just thought that was a really interesting idea. And very different, obviously, than kind of what we see in, obviously, any of the prequels. So this is a unique take on a Force user and, you know, how their abilities come about and why they have them and how strong they are. I don't know. What did you guys think of that, all of that?
Mara Jade, I'm waiting for her to get more interesting for me. Everybody makes a big deal about Mara Jade, and I'm just reading this, and it's just like, what makes Mara Jade so great? I mean, I don't see how she's such a standout character compared to other characters I've read in this book or others. Maybe when we get to Lost Command, we'll see something more from her, but I mean, she has very weak, loose force powers. It's more just, you know, her feelings. I mean, she's not wielding a lightsaber at this point or using, you know, some kind of force punch or something. She's a little bit whiny at this stage of the game. So I'm just kind of waiting to see more from her as we continue through.
But I was going to go to Coruscant and pick up some power converters.
Yeah, so she's perfect for Luke.
Well, see, I don't agree with that opinion of Mara, especially in Dark Force Rising. I think that what makes her compelling and what made her compelling back then was that there was a female character that, and I'm not like harping on it because she's female, but like there was somebody introduced who wasn't Vader, who showed that you didn't need to be a Jedi or even though Sith was an established term by the time this came out, a dark Jedi, to have the Force. Like I think Matthew, you calling out the Inquisitors is a good move, because of the fact that they also speak to, there are people who can be trained in the Force who don't fall along a strictly defined camp of, you know, what faith they follow, as it were. You don't need to be a Jedi and you don't need to be a Sith. You can be a Force user and fall outside of those definitions. And that's what, I mean, for me, that's what always made Mara so intriguing, was she was, you know, the Force was a utility for her, not a calling.
Well, and what I find interesting about Mara, because I do find her interesting, and what I love here is that she is this mystery to kind of figure out. And a lot of people are trying to figure out who this is and where she is from and what she's done in the past. You know, one of them is Luke, and Thrawn's trying to figure that out. And, you know, we learn more about her in this story, and I find it kind of fascinating. And this really was the first time we had an idea that the Emperor had surrounded himself with more people than just Vader who would go out and do his bidding. It wasn't just the Emperor and Vader who were responsible for enforcing things forcefully in the galaxy. And I really like that. And I like the slow burn that we're not going to just like dump this character and try. And I feel like Bruce might make her important immediately. It's more like, no, we're going to continue. We've introduced all these new characters, and we're going to slowly build her into being somebody who's important. Other than the moment you open the book, here's the new female character. She's important, and you're going to know she's important because we're going to talk about her a lot. You know, like, no, she just organically fits into the story, and as we're moving forward, we're finding out more about her, and the more we find out about her, the more interested I am. And part of that, I know who she's going to become too, and I always ended up loving Mara Jade, and you know,
maybe that's where I'm coming from. Is everybody's made such a big deal about her, and I'm expecting more of that up front, and I'm just kind of like, okay, I mean, she's cool, but she's not like this standout character amongst all these other characters in this book that makes me want to go, oh my gosh, Mara Jade is the best, she's so awesome. And I'm kind of, maybe I'm just waiting for that moment, maybe it's that slow build, and when we get to the next book, and believe me, these books are already making me want to read other books, so it's just adding to my freaking reading list, which I don't need right now.
I completely understand that. Well, you know, what I love about this storyline, like you said, Bruce, there is a part of this is really making me want to go back and reread certain parts of the old EU, because I did like, you know, Mara and these other characters and where they were going to go. Really, honestly, it kind of makes me want to just go back and reread the Thrawn duology, the Hand of Thrawn duology that Zahn wrote, because, you know, that's really where that continuation for Luke and like, say, Mara happens, because that's where they finally truly fall in love and decide that they want to be together, and that continues that story. I almost kind of wish that Zahn had been the only one to write Star Wars books for a while, more than just this first trilogy, so that we would have kind of had more one vision behind things, because I think that was one of the downfalls of the EU until they got a tighter rein on things and were trying to really more control the story and make it all fit together as well as it did and be more consistent with characters and all. So all in all, yeah, what would you guys end up rating Dark Force Rising?
Okay, I'll go first. I will, you know, I will go ahead and give it 3.5 dreadnoughts out of 5.
Wow. That's, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking 3.5 or 4. And then I thought, can I really do a half? But I'm going to go with 4. It was a bit crowded, as we mentioned, but as it was building, I like the conclusion. I like where it all kind of pulled together and wrapped up. I'm glad Leia was given more to do. My concern from the last book and then in the beginning of this book, it seemed that everybody was into protecting Leia and putting her off to the side I didn't feel like she was coming across as a hero. Until
nobody puts Lady Vader in a corner.
Yeah, until we brought Lady Vader in. So that was really cool. And one of my favorite parts, and I don't know why, but when Sabaoth or whatever we're calling him, starts throwing rocks at Mara's ship using the Force.
Oh, yeah. Rocks at her ship.
I thought, that's pretty cool. I like that.
That was neat. That was neat.
And also, like, the reverse of the trash compactor scene.
Yes, that was hilarious.
Oh, that was pretty clever.
That was
hilarious. That was pretty clever.
And Luke being like, in his head, they don't smell any better.
And instead of going down to the trash compactor, he's going to go up through the trash compactor to the detention cell and then back down again. So that was pretty cool. So there's little bits and things in there like that that I liked. And I do like viewing this book from the perspective of being familiar with the prequel trilogy and just seeing, you know, where Timothy Zahn's head is and where he wants to create his version of the Star Wars universe from what he was given at that time. So, yeah, I give it, I don't want to say hot chocolates again because I did that last time. So I'll give it 4 flying rocks.
Nice.
Flying
all right. Well, you know, I really love the tapestry that Zahn is weaving. I mean, and that's, you know, when I came to the realization, especially by the time that I got to the end of this book, that Zahn is weaving a 3-book tapestry and there's really only a beginning and an ending. I think that really helped me to come to terms with how much is going on. And even the whole idea that there's so much going on when you're in a galaxy the size of the Star Wars galaxy, to me, that kind of made it feel more realistic that there's so much going on. And so, and I know that's kind of weird to say about a, you know, fantasy sci-fi book series, but I enjoyed it. And, you know, it's not a perfect book. We've talked about a few of the things that just kind of fall a little bit flat, and especially that Han and Lando story, it kind of drags a little bit. Again, I like the prequel reference where they go underwater for the first time and have an underwater, you know, submarine place where people are gambling. So I just imagine there being Gungans there in the back of my mind. You know, to me, this is 4 out of 5 lost dreadnoughts. You know, it is not perfect, but I think it's still very strong. And I'm crossing my fingers that the end is going to be the best of the stories, especially since I feel like hopefully Zahn has even more of a grasp on where he's going and what he's doing with all these characters, so that as he's wrapping everything up, it can hopefully be the strongest. Usually for me, I tend to like the middle stories the best, like Empire Strikes Back, Catching Fire was my favorite, you know, things like that. But this one, I still, I think, if I was looking at them just as we are now, Heir to the Empire, I think, was stronger than this one, which isn't unusual usually for me. But I can't wait to wrap it up with The Last Command. Been fantastic. We get to bring these shows to you because of our associate producers every week through Patreon. We've got Ken Tripp and Davis Grayson. Really want to say thank you to them for their support of the network and the show. Through Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/trekfm and you can see how you can be part of the team and make sure that we get to bring all of this great content to you through Trek FM each and every week. And the reason that is we are a listener-supported network. It does cost quite a bit to host a network of this size and magnitude. You can't do that for free with a network of this magnitude, is Admiral Akbar would say. So check out patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can help us. We've got great things we want to give back to you, exclusive content, producer credit, seats on the content development team, and so much more. So I really want to say thank you for all of you that make this happen. And after doing it for 3 years and continuing now on my fourth year of podcasting with Trek FM, it's been just an all-out joy. So, well, Bruce, before we let you leave the 602 Club, tell everybody where they can find you online. And I know that you have a great podcast of your own that you do.
I can be found on Twitter at @Admiral_Rex. And I have a few writings on StarWarsReport.com. And I'm co-host of Cloud City Casino, which is a gaming and collecting and all things fandom podcast. And if you like listening to this show that you just heard, you may want to listen to Cloud City Casino episode 25, since Matthew Rushing is on that episode.
And I have to say, it was a fine night at the casino.
Yes, and that had smell issues too.
It did. It did. Wookiees all over the place, but you'll have to listen to the episode to figure that out. John, before we let you go, there are plenty of places online for people to catch up with you. You're doing reviews of things on ShowVote. You've got podcasts. You've got Twitter. Tell everybody where to find you.
Well, thank you, Matthew. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter @KesselJunkie. You can find me right here on the network during the final season of Commentary Trek Stars, where we look at the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. We're actually in the midst of our Simon Pegg retrospective, and it's pretty great. We're having a good time with that.
Freaking Simon Pegg!
Exactly. And we are, you know, having a good time. It's we're looking at all of the creators who are putting Star Trek Beyond together. So that's our focus for this this final season. I'm also on a podcast called Words with Nerds that I co-host with my buddy Craig. That drops on Thursdays on iTunes and all the other places. And as you mentioned, thank you. I am writing some pieces for ShowVote.com with a special focus, big surprise, on Star Wars stuff.
Wow, we've got the crack team right here for Star Wars content. It's because of you guys, too. You know, the Star Wars feed has done really, really well. You know, I'm just so proud of the content that we've put out there. And mainly it's because we get to have these kind of conversations. You know, I invite great people in, and I just try to keep up. So thank you guys for making it such a success. You can find me at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek and interview the authors. I do The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we talk about Deep Space Nine. You can find me on Instagram at MRushing. You can also find Trek FM there now. You can also find me on my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And may the Force be with you.
Matthew, you're the best.